I'm ready if you are.
Let's go.
All right, everybody. Welcome to this next episode of the Renegade HPG podcast. We have another blast from the past as I was able to connect with Joel Bisk here. Joel was the staff artist for FASA way back in the day, coming on, I believe, 1989 through the late 90s. Kind of worked for many years there as a staff artist before progressing to one of the art directors. And we're going to be chatting today, just kind of looking back at a lot of the projects that Joel was involved in, including, I believe, the 20-year update might have been your first, and then TRR 3050 and many more. We'll just kind of be reminiscing for you guys, give you guys some insight into kind of what went on behind the scenes there, and anything else that kind of pops into our head. But Joel, thanks a lot for joining me tonight. It's great to kind of have you, and looking forward to this.
Well, thanks for having me. You know, it's like I was saying, it's fun to kind of reminisce about this stuff that for me happened so long ago.
Indeed. Yeah. And we were talking about before I hit the record is that, I imagine when I have these conversations, kind of someone coming up to me out of the blue and asking about something I did 30 years ago and how I would feel about it. So it's, must be a little surreal, but,
it would be more surreal if we didn't have social media.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot of how I've reconnected, both with friends and with fans. Because to be honest, you were correct. I started in early 1989 and was there on staff through late 97. And I continued to work remotely once I moved to Florida until early 98, which was when FASA went through a big contraction. Which I guess was maybe a year and a half before they finally closed up doors on the original FASA. So I was there through a big chunk of original FASA's lifespan.
So, and what was that original contact? How did you connect with FASA and that in '89?
I went to an art school in Chicago called the American Academy of Art, and I was going to be a comic book artist. That was it. Where I was going. I had been a gamer, mostly Dungeons and Dragons and Villains and Vigilantes, which is an old superhero role-playing game, which, of course, I do comics and now I can role play comics. So that was kind of how that, you know, that was the interest. And after graduating, I graduated in summer of 88 was kind of doing samples and, you know, muddling around trying to, you know, figure out how to even do this. A couple of my buddies that I went to art school with had gotten some work with FASA, working on a couple of the products. And I had been talking to them and they were like, you know, you should contact these guys because they're right here in Chicago and, you know, you can go ahead and, you know, get some freelance from them. And so I got their information and called them up and set up an interview and went down to the original FASA site, which was on Van Buren Street, interviewed. And while I was doing the interview, Dana, who was the art director at the time, asked if I was interested in freelance or full time. And I was like, well, I was figuring on freelance because, you know, that's what we do. But if you've got full time work, that'd be great.
Definitely.
Knowing not a whole lot about what they did. Other than I knew that they were a role-playing game company, and I had researched their products, so I knew that they did BattleTech, and they still had Star Trek at the time, and Renegade Legion, and I'm trying to think. I think most of the other older stuff had kind of dwindled away. It was mostly BattleTech and Renegade Legion and Star Trek were the current works. So I did a couple of new samples, new BattleTech samples, which were frankly awful. I found them. They're buried somewhere on a shelf over here. they're they're not real good. The mechs don't look good. They're kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
Someday I'll actually scan them so that people can see them. But I tried to make sure that was one of the things we, you know, if you're going to interview for a job, you tailor to that job. So I made it a point to do a couple of samples and, had a good interview with the guys. It was, Jim and Jeff and Dana. That kind of interview was a little rigid. That was more like we sat around and talked for an hour.
Right.
And, so I went home and, I had been working with my dad as an electrician. I was working in his shop, the shop that he worked for, kind of running supplies to people. And, dad was very good at kind of pushing. So he basically was around the same time had said, you know, you sit around, you do drawings all day long. You haven't gotten any work. What are you doing? Okay. Well, he goes, I want to see that you're making an effort. So he said, otherwise I'm going to tell Billy to fire you so that now you have to find a job,
mm-hmm.
or you're going to go down to the union hall and you're going to become a union electrician and do that. So fortunately, this all timed out perfectly because that all kind of happened within about 2 weeks. So dad, of course, stayed on me. Did you call him back? Did you call him back and say, thank you for the interview? Okay. So I called him back and said, you know, asked for Dana, thanked him for the interview. And that was about a couple days later. And then I just waited. And dad's like, have you called him? No. He's like, well, call him. You know, it's, you know, don't let this just go away. Call him. So I waited another week. So it was probably about 2 weeks. And I called up and I said, I was just checking in and I wanted to know if you'd made any decisions or if you needed any other information, you know, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. And Dana said that we're still thinking about it. And so I waited another week, 2 weeks, something like that, and called back again. And Dana offered me the job. And I found out later that they had narrowed it down to three of us. It was me and Earl Geyer, who was one of our, he was a longtime freelancer with us.
Yeah.
And one other person who I can't remember who it was. But basically, I was the one that called back.
Okay. Oh, perfect.
So dad's advice worked because I was the one that called back. Excellent. So that's how I initially got the job. So
yeah.
I came in and we were in a little tiny office. We were above a printing press, a printing company on the first floor. We were on the second floor and our warehouse was up on the third floor. And the front of the building was we had little light tables that were maybe 4 feet long and, you know, 3 feet deep. And I had some bookshelves that were right next to me. So I was in this little cave and Dana was literally right behind me. I mean, literally if we both backed up at the same time, we would hit each other
because
there was maybe 10 feet of space from wall to wall. And then Jim and Jeff were right down there and across from behind Jeff was Sam Lewis, who was the BattleTech developer at the time. And
right.
Then a little bit down the hall were the editors and that was it. That was the company. You know, a couple of guys in the warehouse and then Jordan and Ross and Mort, the owners of the company. And that was it. That was everybody.
And now what was the first major project that you dove into when you were there?
That was 20-year update.
Okay.
I spent a couple of weeks basically familiarizing myself with the universe because all I knew was that it was kind of like Robotech visually. Okay. I had no idea what the universe was like, what the universe was about. So I just pretty much read the five house books cover to cover. I went through 3025 to familiarize myself with the mechs and read all of the novels that were out at the time.
Okay.
So I would do some sketches and I'd read a couple chapters and I'd do some more sketches and read a couple chapters. And then 20-year update was the first official assignment, the first book that I worked on. So that was where I started with them.
Now, if I recall from my conversation with Michael Stackpole, that the 20-year update was essentially kind of arose from that jump that they decided on in the novels. Does that sound right? That when Mike said that he pretty much had better stories for the next generation, you know, in kind of that 30-50 time frame, than just going into the 30-30s, that they eventually kind of ran with that, and then it became the Blood of Kerensky and the clans. But that 20-year update was essentially kind of a way to bridge that. Is that an accurate kind of understanding, recollection then?
Honestly, if that's what Mike said, yeah. I would certainly agree with that. Honestly, I just kind of came in and got plopped down into it. I was at that point still familiarizing myself with the universe. So I kind of understood okay, 20 year update. I understand what that is. But it took a little bit of time for me to really get up and running on what the universe was and all of the intricacies of, you know, the political intrigue between the different houses.
Right.
That was all something that was really, really new to me. So trying to kind of get that, like even to the point of trying to illustrate some of the characters for 20-year update, which I did most of in there. I had no idea who any of these people were. So, yeah. Okay, this is Davion, that's that source book there. And this is Merrick. So that's that one. So for me, it was just, you know, trying to make sure that the characters looked like they were supposed to.
Right.
So as far as how that came about, that kind of predates me. By the time I got there, the book was already in editing, and came through so that we could then start drawing it. So, the development part of it, I'm not necessarily as familiar with some of it. Kind of depends on the product for me.
And then how much, I guess, communication, how much collaboration was there with the people in the office just to, to get kind of a consistent visual aesthetic there?
Well, I think generally when you had the developers, whoever the BattleTech developer happened to be, whether it was Sam or either of the Nystil brothers, or Rob later on, you know, the different people, they made sure that they kind of directed the universe from a storytelling scope.
Yeah.
As far as what we did, we got a good bit of freedom. Again, I wasn't there for the initial, the 3025 book that Dwayne Luce did all of the BattleTech drawings. So
right.
I've seen all the originals. We had all the artwork there, but I wasn't there to know how did he figure out what they were. You know, I don't know if he got any updates. I know that by the time I was drawing them, I pretty much had freedom to make them look like whatever I wanted to. So for me, it was one of two things for any of the mechs that would have been new mechs for 3050 would have been, and now I'm also talking about Inner Sphere mechs. The clan mechs were all designed by Steve Venters, who at the time was renting space from us upstairs, in the warehouse. There was a big area of the warehouse was just open. So he kind of put a studio up there. So we had freelanced him the job in 3050 to design the clan mechs.
And what kind of work was Steve focused on? Was he an artist as well, just freelancing? Or I know was he an industrial designer?
He was an industrial designer. And initially we had contacted Dwayne to do 3050, but he wasn't available to do it. I actually had to go back through, and I don't have those source books anymore. So I had to go back and dig through PDFs of them, and I'm like, wow, I don't even remember doing some of this stuff. when they did the 3050 update, a lot of that next generation of BattleTech, I would assume that it was Sam and Jordan and Ross, Jordan and Ross at that point were still very hands-on with the products. As time went on and they kind of moved on to the BattleTech centers and Fast Interactive, they were involved much less in the day-to-day operation.
Gotcha.
But back then, you know, Jordan would come into the art department. He was very much a creative person. So there was a lot of stuff where those guys, Sam and Ross and Jordan, would kind of sit down and move that direction forward from a story standpoint for BattleTech. So when we were doing the 3050 update, it became much more of, we've got some new battle mechs. Some of them were based off of other battle mechs. So they were, you know, variants.
Right.
Like one of the ones that I designed was the Axeman, which was a bigger version of the Hatchet Man.
Right.
Which was basically the description I was given.
Okay.
So other than that, I tried to keep the flavor of what the original Hatchet Man looked like, and then kind of give it its own, a little bit of its own flavor. And there were a few battle mechs. The Hatamoto Chi, I think, was based off a Charger.
Correct. Yep.
And again, it was an Asian looking version of a Charger. That's kind of the description I got. So beyond that, whatever ended up in the book was kind of, okay, here's my version of it.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty much, we had a lot of freedom as far as that's concerned. Occasionally, if there was a request, you know, Sam decided, oh, we want this mech, we need it to look like this, it serves this purpose. There would occasionally be a little bit more direction like that. But for the most part, it was like, okay, I've got a name and I've got some stats, which more often than not, I would have to ask about because
right.
I don't play the game. So
yeah,
so for me, you know, telling me there's not enough heat sinks on it doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, that's the kind of thing where it's like, I'm just trying to make sure that they're interesting looking, you know, and something that I would like to draw on. So that's kind of where it comes from my standpoint.
And now when I look in the credits for these books, you know, you see a lot of different things. I have one beside me here, you know, it has illustration, it has you and Jim and Dana and Steve listed there. And then it has art director is Jim, production is Sam. Like what, where do you guys all fit in that process? Is it, do you all collaborate to create a Hatamoto Chi, or, you know, is it just you get that mech and you know, Jim gets X mech and you get the Axeman and he gets, I don't know, Stinger update or something?
The way that 3050 in particular came about, which is a little bit of, there's a little difference between the tech readouts and like just a regular source book.
Right.
With the tech readouts, because it's all battle mechs. Like I said, initially we had hoped that we could get Dwayne Luce to do the 3050 update, and he wasn't available. So that kind of left us with, okay, what do we do about these? We got a, you know, 100, 200 battle mechs and ships to draw. So basically what we ended up doing, there was another guy, I don't remember, I think he worked on 3050, who we kind of gave a few to as a tryout, Leon Gore. I don't remember if it was 3050 or 3055.
Okay.
But he was in one of those books, and he did a few of them. But basically what we did with 3050 was I penciled most of the battle mechs, probably 80-85% of the Inner Sphere mechs. And Dana also took on the leftover Inner Sphere mechs, just for time-saving purposes. And Jim inked them all so that they would all have a kind of cohesive final look. So in that case with 3050, it was an effort to, we kind of felt that Jim's final line work would be the closest we could come to in the office of doing what Dwayne had done, or an evolution of what Dwayne had done for 3025. So basically I sat down and did the pencil drawings, poses, you know, the all the shapes, making sure that the armament, that the visual armament was correct. And then those all went to Jim, and Jim then did the final line work over everything.
And so, you know, as a non-artist, you know, with the loose familiarity and maybe trying to clarify for people who are just non-artists in general, so you're essentially creating a sketch, and I'm imagining that as a pencil sketch, and there's a lot of kind of, you know, there's a general impression of what the final item is, but there's a lot of kind of extra in there. And then are you saying, and Jim comes in with the pen work, is that what you said? And work, and he basically takes that rough outline that you've created and makes the final lines definitive and picks it. So, you know, what is, you know, I guess, just to kind of understand what those roles, even, you know, and you said you were interested in comic books. Even it's interesting when I was listening to some documentaries on comic books, of understanding that there's really kind of three stages, I guess, in creating comic art, between, you know, the line art, the coloring, and then the final product. I don't even know if I have those names right, but and so I'm trying to kind of understand how that works, and kind of the liner as well, because in the, you know, on things like Sarna, which is a resource for BattleTech and looking for things, you know, it has just one artist credited to most of them, and I think TR3050 is mostly credited to Dana. And so I'm just kind of curious what actually is kind of where those creations, you know, visually are coming from.
Pretty much when we would do, and I wish I had some of my sketches, any of that kind of stuff around to kind of show.
Let me do a quick screen share here.
Sure.
Joel, and then we can talk about it while we look at it there. So do you recognize this one?
Yeah.
The Wolf Trap. Okay. So like coming down here, it has you credited there. That's because I pulled it off your page, but actually the Caesar and the Wolf Trap here were the only ones that had your credit. Most of them credit to Dana. And so, you know, what are each person's role within creating this image?
Well, now basically the thing, this is mine. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've noticed, I've seen that there's a lot of inaccurate information out there on a lot of this kind of stuff, basically because when we put the credits page in, we literally just list anybody that worked on it.
Yeah, right.
We don't break it down to tell everybody. I don't remember why we didn't sign these, like, you know, why Jim didn't sign them all, and then
because I know Dwayne signed his in TRO 3025. Yeah, you know, they're all,
you know, and it might have just been a time thing. I honestly don't remember why we didn't. But basically, looking at this, the Wolf Trap here, what I would have done is all of the basic shapes that you're seeing would have all been mine, even down to on the left arm shoulder, the kind of circle in there. And the edging that's around that shoulder epaulet there.
Okay.
I would have penciled all that in. But if you look at the detail work of, you know, like how many lines he chose to put and the different plates along the arm, I didn't do a lot of that detail work. I left that up to Jim.
Okay.
So like looking at the legs, I would have made sure that those center pieces on the legs, on the lower legs, I would have drawn those, but I wouldn't have done, you know, like how many lines there have to be there. And, those choices Jim made, the thickness of the lines, that kind of stuff, Jim made those decisions. Okay. You know, so that's kind of the way that stuff, comes about in this case, how it comes about. I'm not quite sure why Dana kind of ends up credited with much of this book. Mm-hmm. Cause I, like I said, I went through the whole thing and I think probably 80 to 85% of the Innosphere mechs were all penciled by me.
Okay.
I could show you quickly the ones that Dana did, just because he's got a very different look than what I do. So my stuff tends to have a more comic booky look, yeah, even at this point, just because of mostly in the way this stuff is posed.
Okay.
Which is funny, because I look at this stuff and I think, oh, I shouldn't have done that way.
Yeah, that's the curse of like putting your stuff out into the public, right?
Yeah. I look at the Wolf Trap and that right arm is kind of just like this.
Yeah.
But had I done that later in my career, mm-hmm, I would have done these poses in more of a way so you could actually see exactly how that works.
Gotcha.
Where here I was just trying to make cool drawings.
Yeah.
So, those are the kinds of things that, as you look, as I look through this stuff, 30 years later, mm-hmm, and what I've actually done here. In this case, that's pretty much how this came about, is that I did all the pencil work, and I was none of us, Jim, Dana, or I, were fast enough to do this start to finish ourselves.
Okay.
So a lot of the breakdown for who did what when was time saving, which honestly is originally how comic books started that out.
Right.
With comic books, it was very much back in the 50s and the 60s, you had a person that would pencil it, and then you had a different person that would ink it, mainly because they weren't fast enough to do it themselves. So initially, comic book inking came about because you needed the black line to get it, the old-fashioned printing, to print correctly.
Okay.
It later turned into more of a collaboration versus, somebody just going over the lines as quickly as possible to make it print ready.
Got it.
So that's kind of the gist of where these kind of went.
So when you're creating a mech like the Wolf Trap here, which is this the first time it appeared,
yeah,
so what are you given? Like, is this completely out of your imagination, or are you given rough specs? Or are you just getting, this is the weapons to put it on and figure it out from there? Like, what is, what's the starting point, I guess?
I would have been given the technical data that showed up on the other page.
Okay.
Occasionally, like I mentioned with the Axeman or the Hatamoto, mm-hmm, I would have been told, okay, this is a variant on this battle mech, in which case I was trying to keep the flavor of the original at the same time. Mm-hmm. With something like this, it was just trying to come up with an interesting design. And I'm looking at it, and it's like, I it's funny, because I remember some of the decision making that I made.
Okay.
Like the right arm is obviously, I was told that's what's on the right arm.
Yeah.
The left arm, being a hand, I don't know why it's only got four fingers. I don't know why I made that decision. I wanted the intention was to give it more of a snout, playing off the wolf aspect of it.
Okay.
And I don't know that that came across. I probably just wasn't good enough back then to really get that across. And I tried to give it more of a hunched over look, because of that. These are the things that kind of come to mind.
Right.
Looking at it and remembering little bits and pieces of oh yeah, I was trying to do that.
Is there a mech in this catalog that stands out? That's something that's you just really remember kind of building it from scratch, and a lot of decisions, or one that you're particularly happy with?
When I went back and looked through it, there were a few that I felt like I did get the feel that I wanted for some of the mechs. There's some of them that I just hate.
Hmm. What's one you hate?
I'm trying to remember. I looked through them and I can, let me see if I can.
I should be able to pull up the full list here. I won't have the pictures, but yeah, here we got the full list. Now, I know I'll pull this out of you because you were talking about it in your podcast with All Ones, which I recommend people check out after this one, which is another fun conversation. But the Raven you were talking about.
The Raven was one. Yeah, and that's, I'm trying to think. Yeah, that's my image.
That's beautiful. That's one of my favorites, Joel.
This one, like I said, I look at it now and I wish that I had just turned it slightly so you can see that back set of armament that's back here. So you could have seen that a little better, because that's one of the things that, as a, you know, being new at drawing the battle mechs and drawing this many of them and trying to come up with individual poses, I don't know how Dwayne did this by himself, honestly. but yeah, the Raven was one that there was a really quick, very underfinished drawing in one of the old source books that Todd had done.
Okay.
And Sam, who again was the developer at the time, was Sam remembered everything. So he's like, oh yeah, there's a Raven somewhere. And I was like,
let's see if they have that down here. Sometimes they have the full catalog.
Sometimes they have some of the see, that one's credited. That one's I don't see the bad original. Honestly, I don't even remember what book it was in. It was one of the older modules. But other than that, I couldn't tell you which one.
Gotcha.
So I kind of kept that same shape of the body.
Okay.
And the rest of it, I just tried to make a more interesting, an interesting feel to how the legs were, how it looked. To give it a little, this is one where I did add a little bit more detail, and then Jim took that and ran with it.
Mm-hmm.
This one is something that I like, just because I didn't even realize this, that the Raven is actually a little more well known now.
Yeah, the Raven has definitely stood the test of time. It's one of the more recognizable ones for sure. And even in Jordan's current project with the BattleTech the game, mm-hmm. I know they use the Raven as a prominent art in one of their expansions for the urban combat. But,
well, and that's one of the things. One of the guys that I work with now, we were talking one day, and he was like, "Oh, you did the Raven? I love the Raven. Yeah. That's great. I play that." And I'm like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah, and I know Bruce's take on the Raven here is definitely a favorite too. That was a great one. But I think the Raven just really stands out because it's distinct, but it still fits. It still fits in the universe. But
And that's one of the things that I tried to the ones that were already designed, obviously that Dwayne had done.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, I tried not to mess them up too much.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say the urban mech that I did is terrible.
Okay.
Isn't that the big stocky kind of blocky?
It is. If I'm recalling correctly, I might.
And that's one that I remember liking that's it. Like I hate that. I think that's, I just hate that one.
This mech is like has become an urban legend, or not maybe an urban legend, but a legend in general. It is a fan favorite, it's had an interesting history. The new BattleTech Kickstarter, they did a plushie, and the urban mech of all mechs made it as the choice for a mech plushie, the first ever mech plushie. But people love this. I think they eventually. People realize that it's extremely cheap in the game and the rules. And if you actually play it how it's meant to be played in a very limited urban environment, it excels. So, as people kind of pick up on their memes, the urban mech has become a meme in modern BattleTech. So.
Oh, okay. See, and this is one of the ones that I really like Dwayne's image of it. And I didn't do it any justice. The one that he did looks, it's got that thickness to it, but it's just a cool, you know, just yeah, the, that, yeah, nice. I just love the way his looks.
Yeah.
And honestly, the Urban Mech is one that I remember struggling with a lot, trying to get something that worked. And I, you know, if I had to redo it, I would have done it completely differently.
Yeah.
I like almost nothing about my drawing of it at this point. I don't think I kept the proportions right. I don't, you know, there's a lot of it that just it just didn't work. But unfortunately at the time, we had so many of these to do that, I just didn't have time to redo any of them.
Right.
So they were what they were.
I'll pull up one of mine that's kind of splits the community, but I really enjoy this one. I'm curious what your take on the old Caesar is.
I have no idea what the mech itself is like, but this is more one of the images that I thought that I did that really worked.
Yeah.
Again, I have no idea what anybody thinks of the mech itself. You know, and that's something for me that is a very different, you know, my idea is just to get an interesting image out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one, yeah, this one I think worked a lot better for me. So this is one that I like the way it looks.
Yeah, I enjoy this and the mini. I actually love the mini. It's one of my old favorites. But yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of them. So that's interesting. I'll kind of split off and, either follow up with the email or something after this with a list, and we'll get these, the credits fixed so that we know who actually contributed to each of these and which ones were Dana, which ones are yours and Jim's.
Yeah. Cause I could certainly, I can certainly go through that. And like I said, I looked through the PDF of the book and, of this and 3055 as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot I know that Dana gets credited to, and I'm not quite sure why, because it just means, okay, there's people who aren't artists looking at this.
Well, yeah, I think, Sarna is essentially a BattleTech wiki. And so it's everyone's volunteering, contributing. And as you noted, things don't get credited very well. And so, I've definitely found that are just flat out credited to the wrong artist. Whenever I post on social media, I try to kind of share BattleTech art, because the art is a focus of my interest in BattleTech. And I do my best to credit the artist and search it, because, as you know, on the internet, things get shared and the creator gets lost along early in that process. But yeah, I have posted some major artworks actually that were miscredited on Sarna and kind of quickly corrected.
And I think that's something too. That's actually one of the ways that Matt kind of found me in the Shadowrun Facebook group.
Mm-hmm.
Was because I don't play the games, but I have a lot of love for what we did for them.
Right.
Josh Harrison, who is running the FASA stuff for Earth Dawn, he's actually contacted me a few times, because, if I see somebody posting something and they like, oh, I don't know who drew this, I'm like, hold on, I know who, usually I can look at the piece and I know who the artist is.
Right.
Or if I don't, like Josh had contacted me, he's like, okay, I'm looking at one of the box sets, and he's like, there's a couple of pieces and I don't know who did them because they're not signed, and I don't know the artists based on the list of the book. So I had to go through and like, look, okay, this is who we credited. Cause to be honest, the credits that end up in the book aren't always right.
Right.
We do our best to get, the correct names in there, but there's occasional times when somebody forgot an illustration and we've had to pull something else out, or one of us had to do something. So you may end up with like, oh, I didn't think I worked on this book. There must have been a hole that somebody missed. And so like an hour before the printer's coming, I'm rushing out a headshot or something.
Right.
You know, that's the downfall of being a staff artist, is that you get stuck having to fill holes quickly.
Now, Beyond, we talked about 20-year update and 3050. You know, what were some of the other big projects that stood out to you, you know, for your time with FOSSA there?
I actually did a lot of 3055 as well.
Okay.
Which, frankly, I barely remember doing.
Oh, goodness.
I when I pulled that out, and I'm like, oh, because one of the things somebody had asked me a few years ago about some of the BattleTech stuff that I'd done, and mm-hmm. I didn't keep any of those originals.
Okay.
Those all stayed with FASA when I left. So people were sending me, little JPEGs that they found on the internet, and I'm like, all right, I know those are my pencils, but I don't. It looks like Dana. And Dana actually inked most of 3055, and he actually penciled a good chunk of it as well. So Dana ended up inking what I did on 3055. So there's a number of pieces that look a lot like they look more like Dana's stuff at times than they do mine. Mine usually had a lot more dynamic pose to them.
Okay.
Which I think was part of the comic book background.
Got it.
The me growing up doing comic books, you know, you're doing superhero poses. So I just did superhero poses with battle mechs.
Fair. I enjoy that. I'm not a huge fan of kind of the direction modern BattleTech has taken, where, you know, they've really kind of embraced the large tank aspect and gotten away from kind of the Gundam background. You know, I kind of imagine the whole reason of having a battle mech is the mobility. If you're very clunky and linear, then there's probably better ways, you know, to approach that with technology. But so I appreciate that. And speaking of comic book poses, I'm curious what the background is, because it's kind of a, you know, it's not, I don't completely understand, there may be others do, but the contribution of Victor Musical Industries to all those 2C variants, you know, in the middle of the TR-3055, and kind of what was the background in that? Because I know those were caught up in a lot of the unseen lawsuits, and you know, and I'm not quite sure what the relationship is, but it was, they are very distinct, certainly visual in that TRO, and you know, talk about dynamic poses, those things look like they're busting a move on the dance floor. But
are those the color ones?
Those are color ones, and there are a lot of color ones, but you know, if I can do a quick screen share to refresh your memory on some of those. But
it's interesting, because again, I hadn't looked at the tech readouts in probably 15 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled it up. Like I said, I pulled them up. Now that.
So yeah, there were about, I think about 10 of them, maybe a dozen of them in that book, of these, they're all 2Cs, and they're very distinct, you know, much more of kind of the Gundam S style. And there's, you know, I don't know who the individual is behind Victor Musical Industries, but what the story is, but I'm curious if you remember.
You know, it's funny, because I'm looking at this image, and I want to say, and I'm, again, this I'm pulling from memory,
mm-hmm.
purely because I remember this image, but I'm not quite sure where it came from. And Victor Musical kind of rings a bell, and I want to say that it might have been Jordan's connections somewhere.
Okay.
That we got these images, and I believe that these are Japanese images.
They look Japanese, yeah.
And you know, and I mean, it's like, and, you know, we could conceivably mimic, you know, some of us could mimic this kind of style, but
yeah,
these images were ones that we picked up and done.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't remember if we commissioned them or if we second rights these pieces.
Gotcha.
I'm not sure if you understand what the difference there is.
Well, regardless of whether I understand or not, I'm sure we could clarify for people that are listening who may not understand.
But basically, these images, when I say second rights, when if you're a freelancer, like mm-hmm. because I was a staff artist, the work that I did whatever they assigned me to do. It's FASA's work. I was done as a staff employee. If you are a freelancer and you do work for hire, you can sell the work in a couple of different ways. One of the ways that you can sell it is the purchaser, the company that you do the work for, can buy all the rights, all the publishing rights,
mm-hmm.
which FASA didn't really do when I first started there, because really nobody did, because nobody thought about, oh, reprinting this in Germany or reprinting it overseas. And once that started to become more popular, and we started to have the overseas market and translating the books into other languages, the art department said, you know, you don't necessarily have the rights to print these in other languages. Because our contracts were very simple. We need 10 pieces for this book. Boom, done. So we had to rewrite contracts that bought all printing rights.
Okay.
Which means basically FASA could take an image from a freelance artist and use it wherever they want, whenever they want, on whatever they want. It's theirs to own. If they don't do that, it is implied that you're only selling first, what they call first publishing rights.
Mm-hmm.
So if I do a painting for a book cover and all they buy are first rights, the original art is mine, I keep that. And if I want to resell that image to someone else to use, that's my right, because the artwork is mine. Now, if it's got copyrighted material in it, that kind of limits where I can sell it. So that's why I'm not quite sure if those images, which are definitely Japanese in origin.
Yeah.
I don't know if we commissioned those pieces or if those pieces were simply had been done and the rights were open on them so we could buy them as second rights pieces.
Interesting. So maybe I'll give you an example here. I recently commissioned a piece, I'll pull it up here, from DC Bruins, who's active in the community. So if I, as a fan, I commissioned this piece and there's no contract, essentially the implied is that I get first rights of publish, but anybody can use it, you know, that the artist retains the ability to have the original art and do what they want with it, maybe make prints, whatnot, you know.
Yeah,
and then what is, you know, because I know there's a lot in the community that are starting to commission. I've been doing a lot to try to raise the awareness of artists, this artist, DC Bruins, you know, being one of them. You know, they've been doing a lot of commission work. So I think it's interesting. It's helpful to kind of understand what those rights are and what people use. And, you know, for example, if I took this image and somebody wanted to make prints of it and sell those prints, is that something where the rights would fall with the artist, the person who commissioned the artist for the work? Or is there still some legal ambiguity because it's still featured within BattleTech that the BattleTech rights holders would prevent that or own that?
Well, that's a multi answer.
Okay.
The first simple answer is that what can be done depends on two things: the contract, or if there is no contract, here in the U.S. it's an implied ownership of intellectual property.
Okay.
Now you've got two different things here. One is that if you've got a piece of BattleTech art or BattleTech characters,
mm-hmm.
technically, those are owned by Topps.
Yep.
Topps is the current IP holder. So if you commission a piece like this and you're commissioning it because you want a painting to hang on your wall, okay, you own the original artwork. If that's the point, was this is a painting, right. You know, a physical painting that you wanted somebody to do to hang on your wall.
Mm-hmm.
You own the original artwork. You own zero rights unless those were written into the contract.
Okay.
This comes up a lot with comic book artists. So if you go to a Comic-Con, the artists are there, they're doing sketches. All of those sketches, whether you're doing Marvel characters or DC characters, those are all owned. Those IPs are owned by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
The comic industry traditionally has been very lenient about the artists being able to do sketches, cover recreations, cover, you know, whatever, commissions of, but you owning the physical artwork does not give you any reproduction rights, just as if you bought a piece of original comic art, or if you bought like one of my pieces from BattleTech.
Yeah.
All you own is the original art. You know, you legally, you can't publish it. You can't make prints of it. You can't do any of that. As the artist, I own the rights to the artwork itself, unless I have sold those rights.
Okay.
So as a staff artist, FAFSA owns all that work.
Okay.
Unless I did it, we were allowed to freelance to FAFSA to make some extra money.
Yep.
So if it was a piece that we got the same contract then that anyone else did, and this was basically FAFSA being generous enough to do this with us.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a weird thing. But here's an easier example. I've done Magic cards for Magic the Gathering.
Okay.
When Magic first came out, they were paying the artists a set fee and royalties, which for some of the artists who did a lot of cards turned into a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I had done them, which was about four or five years after they started, they were just in the process of changing their contracts to buy all rights. And from a company standpoint, you'd be stupid not to, because if you want to publish your BattleTech book or your Magic cards in another language, you need to have those publishing rights. You need to be able to just give them the art. Here you go. Go use it. So that was actually one of the reasons when, if you look at current Magic art, they have recommissioned art, and now they constantly recommission art for the same cards as they update their core sets.
Right.
Initially, they did that because some of the artists were resistant to taking a buyout to not get royalties anymore.
Okay.
So Wizards said, well, we'll just, we own the rights to the card.
Right.
We'll just put another piece of art on the same card.
Yeah.
And in the long run, that became, well, we can just keep doing that. So they've continued to do that. And they basically pay a flat fee for their artwork because they own all that work. If they want to put it on t-shirts, they want to put it on, you know, if they want to make prints and posters, they can do that. That's they bought those rights. Now the artists, depending on when you've worked on what you've worked on, most of the artists can still make prints of their work. You have to have the copyright Wizards of the Coast and their, you know, copyright Hasbro or whatever the technical copyright is now.
Yeah.
But that's because Wizards allows you to do that.
Okay.
If they decide they want that piece of artwork, if it's something they want to make prints of, they can say, no, you can't make prints of that piece.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have any legal recourse because it's in the contract.
Yeah.
So it's a very malleable thing. So like with the piece that you were showing me, if you wanted, and a lot of it comes down to how much money you're going to make off it. If somebody's going to do that and make prints off it, most companies aren't going to make prints of their artwork, so they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So it's never an issue. But if it's something where, you know, you wanted to sell that image, or the artist wanted to sell that image to, you know, some other company, you kind of, it's kind of up in the air, because number one, they've sold it to you. So if you don't have an actual contract, you really don't have any say in it. You've essentially bought first rights without a contract. But the IP holder, in this case, Tops with BattleTech, could conceivably say, you can't put our IP on that, if they wanted to put it on a book cover or something else.
Right.
You can't necessarily do that. So it's a long-winded kind
No, that's super helpful.
Convoluted.
I know there aren't a lot of prints, because it's not something that Catalyst, Tops does, and so for the artist side, and I would love to see the artists do more prints and put it out to the market, just to support themselves. Because as you noted in your All Ones conversation, the rate of compensation for artists is really the same as it was 30 years ago, and maybe even worse. And so the artists really have to be creative in terms of finding a way to support themselves. And I think that the really good artists out there, if they could, let's say there was no commission involved, there's an artist out there, they create their own art and they sell prints, whatever they want to do with it. I'd love to kind of clarify, or get some insight into kind of the legality of that. And so it sounds like what you're saying is that if an artist created art for themselves, or if somebody commissioned art and bought full rights, then either of those parties could make prints and sell those prints, up until the point where Tops, stepped in and said, we don't want you to do this. Or is it more appropriate for either of those parties to reach out to Tops first to say, hey, can we do that? Or is that not necessary?
It's a lot of it comes down to, whether or not the decision to make something like prints comes about, kind of comes down to how much effort is it? Is it worth the effort to make prints?
Mm-hmm.
If a lot of the magic artists, for instance, have high-end, inkjet printers that they do their prints on.
Yeah.
They don't charge a ton of money for them. I'm not talking about the professional versions. There are some of them that do professional versions and do the play mats and stuff like that. And that's usually, that's usually written into the contract what you can and can't do. So that Wizards is very good about being upfront about, we'll let you do this, we won't let you do this.
Yeah.
For something like BattleTech, there frankly isn't nearly that kind of a market.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a bunch of BattleTech cards for the old card game.
Right.
And the originals for those, I can't sell for nearly what my Magic original sold for.
Right.
Because there just isn't the interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's supply and demand. I still have most of my BattleTech card art. Mm-hmm. I've sold, a few pieces. I sold a piece that has the Raven on it.
Okay.
And I sold the Dushies that I did.
Right.
Which was four or five of them. And one person buy those. But again, I sold the dashis, all of them, for maybe the price of one of my magic pieces.
Gotcha.
Because there's not nearly the interest for it. So, they end up having to be priced accordingly. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do me any good. I mean, they're all sitting on a big shelf here.
Yeah.
So if there's interest in it, well, I'm going to give you a relatively reasonable price.
Right.
I've been paid for the artwork itself years ago.
That's interesting that you brought up the card game. I'd seen that you had done art for the card game. I've actually been heavily involved in the card games with this channel. It was actually the early focus of this channel, was just kind of like diving into the history of the card game and talking to a lot of players, the early world champions. And I've spent a lot of time basically creating custom cards for the card game using the art that's available out there in the community. And so, mm-hmm. It was fun. I didn't realize when we were connected that your art extended into the card game. So that was a fun little surprise when I hopped onto Sarna and saw some of your art there. And, the Daishis, the Widowmaker, you know, being one of them. Alex Mallory is one that I really enjoy from the art there, but it was very cool to do that. And I'll definitely, there's a Facebook group of the people that still play the game and, you know, and enjoy the game. And so I'll definitely kind of connect this podcast to them and let them know that art's up for grabs. Maybe we can get you a little extra spending money, you know, just find the people who are interested, because there's a, you know, a good core group of active players there. It's been a fun ride for me. I'm you know, definitely curious what your experience was with that game, if you were just freelancing at that point or if you had any insight into the kind of development of that game.
We were all because Wizards produced the game, mm-hmm. basically they worked very closely with our BattleTech developer to ensure that they were making a game that kept the flavor of the board game.
Yep.
The miniatures game. Again, I don't play, so I don't know how successful they were. I know that they went through a number of, you know, for the time period, it was a fairly successful game. They went through a whole number of updates and things. So it felt like it was one and then gone.
It really just died with FASA, you know, when FASA died. The game died with it. But the mechanics are actually superior. That's why a lot of people like it, you know, still to this day, because the mechanics of the game are so solid. There were some design issues that happened, you know, about a year and a half, 2 years into it, which started to kind of skew how the game played, but they started to recover that in the later sets right before it got canceled. But yeah, it was, you know, once FASA shut down, it kind of ended it. The game, but yeah, the mechanics are solid. You know, it's a fun game to play. I picked it up early last year, and you know, that was actually the inspiration for this channel. I picked up the card game. I was interested in it, and I did my first podcast for conversations with, you know, some of the more active players in the community, the people that have been kind of keeping the Facebook alive, and then I ended up interviewing the world champions, the first two world champions for the game. So you know, it was fun. It's a solid thing. If, you know, I have an interest myself in trying to see that a card game, not that card game, but a BattleTech card game come back to market. You know, and hopefully some conversations with the head brass at CGL can kind of, you know, move that idea forward. But
you know, it's interesting because that, you know, it came about and I continued to do BattleTech cards mm-hmm. long after I left FASA, because of course the game came out shortly before I left.
Yep.
So I want to say it was only the first couple of sets that I did while I was still in Chicago, and mm-hmm. then I moved here to Florida, and continued to do cards. And I was lucky too that they just happened to assign me the original Daishi, and subsequent to that, they tried to get the same artist to continue to do those cards. So okay. I did four or five different ones.
Yeah.
After that. And if I'm recalling it correctly, I people tell me that it was a fairly popular mech in the card game. I have no idea if it's good or bad, but
the people enjoyed the arts very much. Unfortunately the way the game was designed, it did not really allow mechs that large to get played. You know, the mechanics pushed it into favoring cheap, fast mechs, and that was some of the things they were trying to kind of correct in the design when the game ultimately shut down. And so it still remains in the game that that getting things out fast and cheap is the dominant strategy. Mm. And unfortunately, it never got to the point where the Daishis were playable. And we've had that conversation actually. And that was actually one of the inspirations for me kind of making my custom cards. And it was one of the first custom cards I did was the Daishi to make it a playable mech. So you can put it on the table and enjoy it. Hmm.
That's interesting. Yeah. Cause I know that when the first couple of years that the game was out, I actually had a lot of people tell me how much they liked it, which actually makes me feel good, because now I'm realizing, oh, they actually just like my artwork.
Yeah.
The cards the card's not usable.
Yeah, so the card is not usable. And I think, you know, that on the, if you do an internet search, you know, you'll find your Widowmaker art and your Daishi S, I think it might be, out there. Whoever bought it kind of posted their kind of framed version of it with their card, you know, in a kind of little matte frame. So, really? It'll be, if you just do a little Google search for your name and art, and those will pop up kind of, I think, close to the top.
Yeah, I know one of them. See, and I only remember them by what they look like. I don't remember which one's which.
Right.
I know which one the Widowmaker is, because that one's a little more distinctive as far as what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know there was one that I did that kind of had rocks in it that was more of a bluish color. And then there was one that was kind of like pinks and purples. And then there was one that was like a down shot that was more, you know, greens. And
yeah, the pinks and purples was the prime. The down shot was the B. The second one you mentioned with kind of the blues, I believe was the S, and then the Widowmaker. And I can't remember what the A was, if I'm remembering correctly, but yeah, that's funny. It's funny how you remember as an artist kind of what's
yeah. Back. So, it was funny because a lot of the stuff, a lot of my artwork I had scanned, and I scanned the stuff and I'm like, okay, I don't even remember what the card names are. I don't remember what the mech names are on half of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So I literally had a bunch of them just listed as Battle Mech 1, Battle Mech 2, Battle Mech 3, Battle Mech 4, because when I had scanned them originally, it's got the names of them underneath. But I didn't, when I scanned them, I cropped all that out. So I just had the image.
Gotcha.
And then I realized, okay, the artwork's packed in a box. I've got these scans that I've never done anything with. So they just had scan names.
Yeah.
You know, untitled one. So I had to go back, and for the longest time, my digital archives were just Mech 1, Mech 2, Mech
3. Yeah.
And I'd have to open them up to even see which one it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I finally, about a year around the time that I sold those, the Daishi pieces, I went and kind of corrected a lot of that stuff, because I was like, okay, because I found all the artwork. So I'm like, okay, so now that's what this is. So I got to change that. And yeah, I did a bunch of cards. They kept calling me to do them, and I'm like, okay.
Awesome.
So yeah, there's a lot of them are really small. I mean, like really small, like that big at the end.
Oh, really?
Because they were, well, you know, they weren't at the time. It's like the deadlines were getting shorter.
Mm-hmm.
They were giving me more and more cards, and I was getting busier with my full-time job. So it's like, well, I'm doing what I can. So I was, you know, and back then I wasn't thinking about any sort of resale value, because up until fairly recently, none of it had resale value.
Right.
You know, I sold my Magic cards, I don't know, 15 years ago now.
Okay.
Maybe 10 or 12 years ago now, right before they all got expensive.
Yeah.
You know,
well, shoot, like six months ago, or even 3 months ago, was the time to sell. The collectibles market was incredible, as in a huge bubble, and settled back to same things. But it was a lot of people with stimulus payments and cryptocurrency that was booming. Mm-hmm. And man, they were just dropping money like crazy on things like Magic and you know, the new Flesh and Blood card game, and even BattleTech. I mean, I get the feeling that, you know, the work I've done has brought some people into BattleTech. That's kind of inflated a little, but I don't think it's that much. But a box of BattleTech cards, you know, anywhere from $200 to the cheapest one up to, I think that most expensive one is like $600 or $700 for a box. So that's crazy. Well,
and, you know, and it's funny because I, you know, every year I'm actually like sitting here on top of my desk. There's one.
Nice. Yeah. That one's probably, if that's limited.
Yep. That's limited.
Yeah. So you could easily sell that for $250 to $300.
And I mean, and it's been sitting there. And then what's the other one I've got here? Crusade.
Ooh, that's a big one. That's a $700-$800 box right there.
And they've been literally sitting here on a shelf for 20 years.
That's awesome.
You know, and
the BattleTech people will drool when they see that, because those Crusade boxes do not pop up very often. But yeah, too funny.
Yeah, and I mean, those are just and every literally a couple times I'm like, oh, I got to put these on eBay. I got to put these on eBay.
And, yeah.
I used to collect toys, and I've been slowly purging.
Yeah.
All of that kind of stuff, just because, you know, years ago back in Chicago, I used to go to the toy shows, and I said, and you know, I rebought all the stuff from my youth. Mm-hmm. So I had boxes and boxes of Star Wars figures. I had Mego toys. I have G.I. Joes. And over the years, it's like, it's gone from basements to garages, to storage units, to garages, to closets. And I'm like, I'm never going to display this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm never going to get to a point where I'm going to do anything with it other than have it sit in a box.
Yeah.
So I've been slowly selling everything off. To the point where, you know, I've got like a small stack of old toys that I just got to take pictures of and those are part of, you know, and those are just the ones that I got as part of, you know, when
right,
you know,
right.
That was part of our compensation, was we got a box of cards.
Awesome.
I have no idea where the other boxes went that I got.
Probably in a box somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
With those boxes, that compensation blows away the compensation you got for some of your actual cards, because like I said,
well, those go for big... it may now.
Yeah. It may now. Yeah. You know, totally.
But yeah, I mean, that, like I said, those, I mean, that first edition, yeah. I want to say they gave us a box of starters and a box of boosters.
Okay.
And so the box of starters is, I opened those and just left that, because I wasn't necessarily going to play the game, but I just wanted to see the cards. And
yeah,
you know, and they gave us the artist proof cards of, you know, I've got piles of white back cards, and
yeah,
you know, and there isn't really any interest in them, so they're just sitting in the box over there.
Yeah, well, we can talk after this. I can certainly happy to help you find buyers for it, because I know the people who would be very happy to take those off your hands. And, and you can pay for a little vacation with the family or something. So how much, do you still stay in touch with your coworkers down there? I know I'm exchanging messages with Jeff for the last month or so. We're trying to nail down a day that we can do a podcast together, but, do you stay in touch with Jeff and Jim and, you know, any other guys there?
Usually mostly just through Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, the problem, particularly with Jim and I, is that we're both sports fans as well.
Okay.
And we keep talking about catching up on the phone, but we both know that we need to block out about 8.5 hours for a phone call.
Yeah.
Because every time we do get on the phone, we talk for hours and hours and hours.
Awesome.
But yeah, I keep in contact with them. We message back and forth, you know, fairly often. So it's, some of the other guys, Jeff and Jim in particular, I stay in fairly close contact with. Some of the other guys, you know, Dana, I know he's out on the West Coast now. You know, so I talk to him through Facebook every now and then. And
yeah.
Same with Mike Nielsen and, you know, some of the other guys. But yeah, Jim was, Jim and I were very close up in Chicago. So we've kind of remained that, and same with Jeff and I, not as close as Jim and I, yeah. But yeah, I still maintain touch with both of those guys pretty often.
And now, were they with you all the way to the end when you left, or were you there a little longer? Cause I know there, you came in after them, you know, cause I know you said Jeff was part of even your interview team.
Yeah. Jim and Jeff were both there before me.
Yeah.
When I left, it's funny, Jeff and I were just talking about this about a week ago.
Yeah.
One of the things that we started to do when I was still living up in Chicago was that Jeff, who was art director for a while, he stepped down so that he could do more artwork, because he just didn't. The art directing job, more often than not, was going to meetings and coordinating. And, you know, you got to assign artwork, but he didn't have time to do as much artwork. So he ended up, you know, stepping down from art director, which was when Jim took over and I became the assistant art director. so that he could do more artwork. And he actually started working from home. He had a new baby, so he was working more at home than he was in the office. So he, when FASA contracted in 1998, they laid off a lot of people. And Jeff and I were both part of that group that got laid off. Okay. Because, of course, I was down here working part-time, and Jeff was working at home. So the kind of out of sight, out of mind. So we both got laid off at that point. And Jim stayed on a little bit longer, but even Jim left the company before they actually closed up.
Gotcha.
You know, I think Fred Hooper was the last art director. Fred came on about a year before I moved down here. But yeah, there were a whole bunch of artists during that time that were staff artists that kind of came and went through the...
Right. And going back to kind of some of your art, we talked a lot about the TRO and a lot of kind of line art with the mech, but there's also, you know, and we're talking about attributing, so I don't know what's attributed correctly or not, but I know there's a cover with a hatchet man that's attributed to you. There's a cover for Living Legends that's attributed to you, which I actually enjoy a lot. So
I'm curious. I did not do any BattleTech covers.
Okay.
So any BattleTech covers that are attributed to me are not actually mine. The Living Legend one, I think you showed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that's Les Dorscheid's.
Okay. Yeah, that style aligns a little bit better because it did stand out.
The Hatchet Man cover, the only Hatchet Man I can think of is the one that Boris did.
The Day of Heroes cover. Is Boris, which is gorgeous. Yeah. That's actually one of my favorite artwork. But the Hatchet Man cover, let's see, I'll do a quick screen share, is this one here is attributed to you. You recognize that one?
Oh, wow.
It has Ray Rostia, Carl Walker, and you as the artist. So I don't know.
Well, that is my artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And that's classic BattleTech. So
this would have been FASA, and so the classic tag is what FanPro.
So that's FanPro. So reprints. I assume that is a piece that I did. That was probably a black and white piece that someone colored and they used for the cover.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's the first time I've actually seen that cover. So that,
yeah, this
that
is the,
isn't, that does look like my art.
Yeah, this is the page with all your credited art. And so we have some of Candace that's credited to you.
Yeah, most of those look like mine. Yeah, that's from 20-year update.
Mm-hmm. And once we get to your, they have this Jenner 2C credit to you. Does that look familiar?
Yeah, that's mine. That's awesome. That's another one that Jim inked.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually that one, that little scribble down at the bottom is my signature.
Oh, there you go. All right. So now we know, you know, keep a close eye out for the signature.
Yeah. And I mean, I've signed my name in different ways over the years. So it's,
yeah.
But yeah, everything looking at, yeah, that's mine.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, from what I can see, those all look like my pieces.
Yeah, a lot of CCG cards in there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's mine. That's not.
So have you ever had the itch to kind of revisit the universe now with your new skill set?
You know, it's interesting because I think I would certainly do a much better job at it now. I've done a little bit of work for Catalyst on Shadowrun.
Okay.
And part of the problem with Catalyst is they pay really, really, really slowly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which I understand it's what they do. So it's, they pay like 60 days after publication.
Okay.
Which is a very slow payment. So for me, if I'm like, okay, I need to make some extra money, that's not who I'm going to go to.
Right.
If it's something, well, okay, they're just going to show up some point down the line. But I don't, I actually have more interest in the visuals of BattleTech now than I did when I was there working on it.
Awesome. Well, in addition to Renegade HPG, I've started a side project, which is basically a community art fund where we raise money from, you know, we're up to like 130 people chipping in a couple bucks a month. And then I use them, that money, to commission artists. And so if you have an itch to revisit it, you know, there will be no 60-day wait. You know, we'd happy to kind of, you know, get you back on as a BattleTech freelancer and kind of let you kind of revisit it in some way. I'll follow up with you on that after the podcast. But, and people listening, they can hop on over to patreon.com/gallery3025. That is the community fund. And yeah, we're waiting on kind of a reimagining, actually, of one of Jeff's old pieces, The Archer in Repairs. We brought on an artist over in Australia, actually. He's kind of doing a modern take of that. And we stayed with The Archer. The patrons, you know, of that gallery voted to kind of keep The Archer. And it's going to be an archer after doing on a field base, curated archer, I think maybe a Galadon regulars archer at a field base, getting kind of repairs and people swarming around it. So that's the current project. And the one before that was actually animation by the same artist that I showed you that the commission I did earlier, which is brilliant. If you haven't seen it, I'll forward it. I think you will really enjoy it. Bruins is a brilliant storyteller and animator, and it's a very cool piece. But
yeah, I'd like to see it.
Yeah. Well, excellent. Well, you know, everybody, if there's any questions you have, you know, maybe shoot them down in the comments, and, you know, maybe Joel will see them, kind of, you know, chip in, but, you know, and support Gallery 3025. And we'll definitely kind of, I'll reach out to Joel, you know, we'll try to recruit him back to universe, get a little homage to kind of those old days, and, you know, and kind of give his modern take on it. But, Joel, I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been a very fun conversation. And,
it's been nice revisiting. It's interesting because there's a lot of stuff that I'm like, oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah. You know,
but yeah, it's interesting to kind of jog the memory and have some of those old memories of what went on back in the day to kind of pop back up into the forefront of my thinking.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, it's been fun, but thanks again. And are there any places people can connect with you online, Joel?
I'm on Facebook.
Okay.
I'm pretty easy to find on Facebook, and I have a website that never ever gets updated.
Okay.
that's the other thing, is when I have a full-time job, I don't really think about it. The work I do now, everything's NDA, so I can't really show anything. So other than the occasional time that I actually get to do some freelance, there's kind of no reason to put anything there, because there's nothing new to put there. So
yeah. And so are you doing a lot of concept art for Disney Star Wars now? Is that what's, you know,
covered? I work for a themed entertainment company now.
Okay.
It's not Disney, it's a third party company.
Okay.
I've recently done some work with Universal. I worked on their new Beijing park that just opened.
Oh, fascinating.
Last week.
Yeah.
But I did some work on that, and a lot of stuff that may or may not ever get built. We do any sort of theming. So a lot of the stuff that I'm doing is overseas, which again, you may or may not ever actually see the artwork that I'm doing, because a lot of what we're doing is then going to architects and builders and groups out there. So it's it's a little, certainly a little different than what I've done to this point.
Gotcha. Well, cool. Well, maybe we'll see it. You know, I think there's a sad amount of concept art, brilliant concept art out there that in those studios that never sees the light of day, but which is sad, but we enjoy the art of yours that has seen the light of day. And so thanks for giving us that back in the day. And, you know, thanks for telling us a little bit about the back history of it. You know,
oh, not a problem. Not a problem. It was fun. Cool. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Joel. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll catch you on the next podcast.